Mr. Sponge's Sporting Tour by R. S. Surtees. Chapter 7. Our Hero Arrives at Laverick Wells. Punctual to the moment, the railway train, conveying the redoubtable genius, glid into the well-lighted, elegant little station of Laverick Wells. And out of a first-class carriage emerged Mr. Sponge, in a down-the-road coat, carrying a horse-sheet wrapper in his hand. So small and insignificant did the station seem after the gigantic ones of London that Mr. Sponge thought he had wasted his money in taking a first-class ticket, seeing there was no one to know. Mr. Leather, who was in attendance, having received him hat in hand with all the deference due to the master of 20 hunters, soon undeceived him on that point. Having eased him of his wrapper and inquired about his luggage and dispatched a porter for a fly, they stood together over the portmanteau and hat-box till it arrived.
"How are the horses?" asked Sponge.
"Oh, the horses be nicely, sir," replied Leather. "They travelled down uncommon well, and I've had 'em both removed sin' they comed, so either on 'em is fit to go in the morning that you think proper."
"Where are the hounds?" asked our hero.
"Hounds be at Whirlypool Windmill," replied Leather. "That's about 5 miles off."
"What sort of country is it?" inquired Sponge.
"It be a stiffish country, from all accounts, with a good deal of water jumping. That is to say, the liffey runs twisting and twining about it like an heel."
"Then I'd better ride the brown, I think," observed Sponge after a pause. "He has size and stride enough to cover anything, if he will but face water."
"I'll warrant him for that," replied Leather. "Only let the Latchfords well into him, and he'll go."
"Are there many hunting men down?" inquired our friend casually.
"Great many," replied Leather. "Great many. Some good hands among 'em too, at least to say they're grooms, though I never believe all these jockeys say."
"There be some on 'em ere now," observed Leather, in an undertone,
with a wink of his roguish eye and a jerk of his head towards where a knot of them stood eyeing our friend most intently.
"Which?" inquired Sponge, looking about the thinly peopled station.
"There," replied Leather. "Those by the bookstall. That be Mr. Waffles," continued he, giving his master a touch in the ribs as he jerked his portmanteau into a fly. "That be Mr. Waffles," repeated he, with a knowing leer.
"Which?" inquired Mr. Sponge eagerly.
"The gent in the green wide-awake hat and big buttoned overcoat," replied Leather. "Just now a-speakin' to the youth in the tweed and all tweed. That be Master Cangy Thornton, as big a little blaggard as any in the place. Lives upon waffles, and yet never has a good word to say for him, no, nor for any one else. And yet, to hear the little devil a-talkin' to him, you'd really fancy he believed there wasn't not never sich another man in the world as Waffles. Not another sich rider, not another sich racket player, not another sich pigeon shooter, not another sich fine chap altogether."
"Has Thornton any horses?" asked Sponge.
"Not he," replied Leather. "Not he, nor the gentleman next him nother. He in the pilot coat, with the whip sticking out of the pocket. Nor the one in the coffee-coloured hat, nor none of 'em on, in fact." Adding, "They all live on Squire Waffles, breakfast with him, dine with him, drink with him, smoke with him, and if any on 'em happen to have a horse, why, they sell to him, and so ride for nothing themselves."
"A convenient sort of gentleman," observed Mr. Sponge, thinking he too might accommodate him. The flyman now touched his hat, indicative of a wish to be off, having a fare waiting elsewhere. Mr. Sponge directed him to proceed to the Brunswick Hotel, while, accompanied by Leather, he proceeded on foot to the stables. Mr. Leather, of course, had the valuable stud under lock and key, with every crevice and air-hole well stuffed with straw, as if they had been the most valuable horses in the world. Having produced the ring key from his pocket, Mr. Leather opened the door, and having got his master in, speedily closed it, lest a breath of fresh air might intrude. Having lighted a lucifer, he turned on the gas, and exhibited the blooming-coated horses, well littered in straw, showing that he was not the man to pay 4.20 shillings a week for nothing. Mr. Sponge stood eyeing them for some seconds with evident approbation.
"If anyone asks you about the horses, you can say they are mine, you know," at length observed he casually, with an emphasis on the mine.
"In course," replied Leather.
"I mean, you needn't say anything about their being jobs," observed Sponge, fearing Leather mightn't exactly take.
"You trust me," replied Leather, with a knowing wink and a jerk of his elbow against his master's side. "You trust me," repeated he, with a look as much as to say, "We understand each other."
"I've added a few to them, indeed," continued Leather, looking to see how his master took it.
"Have you?" observed Mr. Sponge inquiringly. "I've made out that you've as good as 20, one way or another," observed Leather. "Some here, some there, all over, in fact, and that you just run about the country and 'unt with whoever comes uppermost."
"Well, and what's the upshot of it all?" inquired Mr. Sponge, thinking his groom seemed wonderfully enthusiastic in his interest.
"Why, the upshot of it is," replied Leather, "that the men are all mad, and the women all wild to see you. I hear at my club, the Mutton Chop and Mealy Potato Club, which is frequented by flunkies as well as grums, that there's nothing talked of at a dinner or tea but the terrible rich stranger that's a-comin', and the gals are all pulling caps who's to have the first chance."
"Indeed," observed Mr. Sponge, chuckling at the sensation he was created.
"The Miss Shapsets, there be 5 on 'em, have had a great game at Fly Lou for you," continued Leather. "At least so their little maid tells me."
"Fly what?" inquired Mr. Sponge.
"Fly Lou," replied Leather.
"Fly Lou." Mr. Sponge shook his head. For once he was not fly.
"You see," continued Leather in explanation, "their father's one of them tight-laced candlestick priests what owes all sorts of vice and immorality, and won't stand card-playing or gambling or nothing of that sort. So the young ladies, when they want to settle a point, who's to be married first, or who's to have the richest husband, play Fly Lou. S'posing it's at breakfast time, they all sit quiet and sober-like round the table, looking as if butter wouldn't melt in their mouths, and each has a lump of sugar on her plate, or by her cup, or somewhere, and whoever can tice a fly to come to her sugar first wins the wager, or whatever it is they play for."
5 on 'em, as Leather said, being a hopeless number to extract any good from, Mr. Sponge changed the subject by giving orders for the morrow. Mr. Sponge's appearance being decidedly of the sporting order, and his horses maintaining the character, did not alleviate the agitated minds of the sporting beholders, ruffled as they were with the threatening, vaporing insinuations of the coachman groom, Peter Leather. There is nothing sets men's backs up so readily as a hint that anyone is coming to take the shine out of them across country. We have known the most deadly feuds engendered between parties who never spoke to each other by adroit go-betweens reporting to each what the other said, or perhaps did not say, but what the go-betweens knew would so rouse the British Lion as to make each ride to destruction if necessary.
"He's a varmint-looking chap," observed Mr. Waffles, as the party returned from the railway station. "Shouldn't wonder if he can go. Dare say he'll try. Shouldn't wonder if he's floored. Awfully stiff country this for horses that are not used to it. Most likely his or Leicestershire nags used to fly. Won't do here. If he attempts to take some of our big-backed bullfinches in his stride, with a yawner on each side, we'll get to grief."
"Hang him," interrupted Caingey Thornton. "There are good men in all countries."
"So there are," exclaimed Mr. Spareneck, the steeplechase rider. "I've no notion of a fellow lording it because he happens to come out of Leicestershire," rejoined Mr. Thornton.
"Nor I," exclaimed Mr. Spareneck.
"Why doesn't he stay in Leicestershire?"
asked Mr. Hoppy, now raising his voice for the first time, adding, "Who asked him here?"
"Who indeed?" sneered Mr. Thornton.
In this mood, our friends arrived at the Imperial Hotel, where there was always a dinner the day before hunting, a dinner that, somehow, was served up in Mr. Waffle's rooms, who was allowed the privilege of paying for all those who did not pay for themselves, a rather considerable number, we believe. The best of everything being good enough for the guests, and profuse liberality the order of the day, the cloth generally disappeared before a contented audience, whatever humor they might have set down in. As the least people can do who dine at an inn and don't pay their own shot is to drink the health of the man who does pay, Mr. Waffles was always lauded and applauded to the skies. Such a master, such a sportsman, such knowledge, such science, such a pattern card. On this occasion, the toast was received with extra enthusiasm, for the proposer, Mr. Caingey Thornton, who was desperately in want of a mount, after going the rounds of the old laudatory course, alluded to the threatened vaporings of the stranger, and expressed his firm belief that he would meet with his match, a taking of the bull by the horns, that met with very considerable favor from the wine-flushed party, the majority of whom, at that moment, made very small, in their own minds, of the biggest fence that ever was seen. There is nothing so easy as going best pace over the mahogany. Mr. Waffles, who was received with considerable applause and patting of the table, responded to the toast in his usual felicitous style, assuring the company that he lived but for the enjoyment of their charming society, and that all the money in the world would be useless if he hadn't Laverick Wells to spend it in. With regard to the vaporings of a certain gentleman, he thought it would be very odd if some of them could not take the shine out of him, observing that Brag was a good dog, but Holdfast was a better, with certain other sporting similes and phrases, all indicative of showing fight. The steam is soon got up after dinner, and as they were all of the same mind, and all agreed that a gross insult had been offered to the hunt in general, and themselves in particular, the only question was how to revenge it. At last they hit upon it. Old Slock Dolliger, the late master of the hunt, had been in the habit of having Tom Towler, the huntsman, to his lodgings the night before hunting, where, over a glass of gin and water, they discussed the doings of the day and the general arrangements of the country. Mr. Waffles had had him in sometimes, though for a different purpose, at least in reality for a different purpose, though he always made hunting the excuse for sending for him. And that purpose was to try how many silver foxes' heads full of port wine Tom could carry off without tumbling. And the old fellow, being rather licorishly inclined, had never made any objection to the experiment. Mr. Waffles now wanted him to endeavor, under the mellowing influence of drink, to get him to enter cordially into what he knew would be distasteful to the old sportsman's feelings, namely, to substitute a drag for the legitimate find and chase of the fox. Fox hunting, though exciting and exhilarating at times, at all times, except perhaps when the fallows are flying, and the sportsman feels that in all probability the further he goes, the further he is left behind, fox hunting, we say, though exciting and exhilarating, does not, when the real truth is spoken, present such conveniences for neck-breaking as people who take their ideas from Mr. Ackerman's print shop window imagine. That there are large places in most fences is perfectly true, but that there are also weak ones is also the fact, and a practiced eye catches up the latter uncommonly quick. Therefore, though a madman may ride at the big places, a sane man is not expected to follow, and even should anyone be tempted so to do, the madman, having acted pioneer, will have cleared the way, or at all events proved its practicability for the follower. In addition to this, however, hounds having to smell as they go cannot travel at the ultra-steeplechase pace, so opposed to looking before you leap, and so conducive to danger and difficulty, and as going even at a fair pace depends upon the state of the atmosphere and the scent the fox leaves behind, it is evident that where mere daring hard riding is the object, a fox hunt cannot be depended on for furnishing the necessary accommodation. A drag hunt is quite a different thing. A drag can be made to any strength, enabling hounds to run as if they were tied to it, and it can be trailed so as to bring in all the dangerous places in the country with a certain air of plausibility, enabling a man to look round and exclaim, as he crams at a bullfinch or brook, "He's leading us over a most desperate country. Never saw such fencing in all my life." Drag hunting, however, as we said before, is not popular with sportsmen, certainly not with huntsmen, and though our friends with their wounded feelings determined to have one, they had yet to smooth over old Tom to get him to come into their views. That was now the difficulty. End of chapter 7.